was one of Gerald Ford's favorite shows. Oh. And once Gerald Ford rescheduled a press conference so he could watch Policewoman.
Hello world, it's a song that we're singing. Come on, get happy. A whole lot of loving is what we'll be bringing. We'll make you happy.
Welcome to the Pop Culture Preservation Society, the podcast for people born in the Big Wheel generation who knew never to eat Pop Rocks while drinking a Coke.
We believe our Gen X childhoods gave us unforgettable songs, stories, characters, and images. And if we don't talk about them, they'll disappear, like Marshall, Will, and Holly on a routine expedition.
And today, we'll be celebrating the 50th anniversary of some of the most iconic TV shows of our generation. I'm Carolyn.
I'm Kristen.
And I'm Michelle, and we are your pop culture preservationists.
What you see on ABC this fall, you'll be talking about tomorrow.
What you see on ABC this fall, you'll be talking about tomorrow.
Okay, you guys, I've got a big question for you. I want you to tell me, what do Skittles, Post-it notes, and Rubik's Cube all have in common?
They're yummy.
Colorful.
Okay. You write on them. This is not what in common means, I guess.
Yeah, I was going to say, love them. Did you eat?
We love
How
them.
Does the Rubik's Cube taste?
I misunderstood the question.
I'm going with colorful, finally.
Okay, that's a very
good. That's good. Oh my God, you're so much quicker than I am.
That's very good. Well,
stick it. Yeah, I hope your Rubik's Cube is not unless you were eating. Oh, you were eating Skittles first, and then you played with your Rubik's Cube. Then it got
sticky.
Or
you tried to pull the stickers off because you wanted to act like you got it done really fast, and then it got kind of sticky.
Who did that?
Carolyn.
Yeah.
I am offended. Oh, my God.
Well, those were all excellent guesses, ladies. But the truth is that they are all turning 50 years old this year. Can you believe
that? There we go.
We were gifted these amazing inventions in 1974, which you guys, if you think about it, was a half a century ago.
Don't stop it right now.
But
also, did any of us ever stop to think about that there was a year Skittles were invented?
Like, haven't Skittles always been?
I guess if you would have asked me, if this was trivia night, like at the bar, and they were like, here's three choices, what year were Skittles invented? And it's like 1974, 1948, and 1960. I literally would just be dumbfounded. Like, I have no idea. So this was great. I already learned something.
But there was a year without Skittles. Like, in 1973, you couldn't get Skittles.
Oh, gosh. That's so sad. Doesn't it seem, like, crazy that that was 50 years ago? Because I think about, you know, in 1980, 50 years before, that was 1930. And when I was in Yeah, that's that same
time. We're ancient. We're like Andorra.
We are. Guys, but beyond the Rubik's Cube and beyond Post-it notes and Michelle's beloved Skittles, 1974 was a huge year in pop culture. We're going to talk today about the fact that it was a defining year for television. I might even argue the defining year for Gen X kids.
That is so true, because so many of the shows that were born in 1974 went on to be huge in reruns and after-school programming.
Yeah. Right.
And also in 1974, comedy was king. And One Night in particular offered a classic lineup that would seriously make history. It's something that will never happen again, because we don't have lineups anymore.
Know, right?
There's no such thing as a lineup. And it was something that lineup kept us glued to the TV in the family room, mostly together with our families from after dinner until bedtime. And that lineup was Saturday Night, which Remind Magazine points out is now a network wasteland. What was happening in our houses when we grew up on Saturday Night, which was a huge party, turned into a big nothing burger. Mm-hmm. But in 1974,
nothing burger.
In 1974, Saturday Night was a total party for TV's most popular, most sophisticated, and timeliest comedies. And all of them were on CBS. Yes. This was the lineup: All in the Family, MASH, Mary Tyler Moore, The Bob Newhart Show, and The Carol Burnett Show. Wow.
Yeah, that's comedy
gold. It is.
Right?
And it was more than a lineup. And kind of to your point, Kristen, my whole family was home. It was an yeah. experience. Mm. I could tell you what we were having for dinner those nights because my dad yes. was grilling steaks outside.
I was about to say, we all know, and longtime mm-hmm. listeners, I bet you guys all shouted out too. In my head, I wanted to go steak. Yeah. Yes. And then like the yeah. big wedge salad with the ketchup and yeah, the mayonnaise.
The ketchup and yeah. mayonnaise mixed together mm-hmm. for Thousand Island dressing.
Well, and in my house, it was like a race to get jammies on before Mary Tyler Moore started. And my mom would make popcorn and we could have Coke. Praise be.
Seriously.
On Saturday nights with Mary Tyler Moore.
And we'd have did you get these, a bottle or did you have to like pour
no,
it in a glass?
No, ice was important and we had them in the grown-up glasses, which yeah. were these sort of smoky tall tumblers that my mom got out of Does detergent. Did you guys have any glasses from
I've
the
never
detergent
heard of
box?
That detergent.
Yeah, it's called Does. D-U-Z.
I don't have memories of watching TV at 1974. Let's not forget, when 1974 started, I was 4. So I don't have memories of watching television in 1974, being 4 and 5. But I have so many memories of all of these wonderful shows that yeah. began and premiered in 1974 because of what you just said. Mm-hmm. They went on to be in reruns. Somehow I saw the reruns. So,
yes.
So it doesn't, even though I don't have a memory, or for all of you listening who weren't even born until like 75, or maybe were born in 1974, happy 50th birthday this year, by the way. You guys can relate to this whole episode because these are shows that are so important to all of us Gen Xers yeah. and have lived on.
Mm-hmm. Right. They've stood the test of time, really. Mm-hmm. Right. These shows are so much more than just the show, don't you think?
And 1974,
it really saw the debut of some of these most iconic TV shows that are really have become some of our all-time favorites. And I'm curious, do you guys have any thoughts on why this one particular year might have made it a perfect breeding ground for greatness?
I think the world was really changing in 1974. There were lots of forces coming up against each other. Vietnam was happening. The civil rights movement was in full swing. Second wave feminism was in full swing. There was so much that was changing and there were so many attitudes that were bumping up against each other that I think that is a breeding ground for creativity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that the lineups in 1974 seemed to have everything kind of that was representative of what was happening in our world. And this is kind of despite, though, what the networks were trying to do because they wanted to make some changes. And I think this is so interesting. According to a New York Times article from April 20th of 1974, they say fall programming, so fall of 74, mm-hmm. the television networks wanted to cut back on programs that were dealing with violence and stress series concerned more with family life and personal relationships. So they were discarding and canceling shows both for rating inadequacy and in response to the hearings on television violence by the Senate Communications Subcommittee. So there was a whole thing going on mm-hmm. with these violent TV shows. And mm-hmm. they say in this article that many of the new one-hour dramatic shows will eschew law enforcement storylines and gunplay. This cracks me up, you guys. For situations involving truck drivers, school teachers, forest rangers, and game wardens.
Okay, how much of that do you think is in response to Vietnam? Because think about what was being shown on the news every night.
Right.
We needed a reprieve. Well, and that's where one of the shows that we're going to talk about later, that's where it came from. We needed yeah. a reprieve.
Right.
From
we
the
needed
news.
Yeah. That escapism. We really yeah. did.
Right. Mm-hmm. I do think the post-Vietnam
yeah.
Has
and we've been at it for a long time at that point. It had been a long time. And still, think of the footage. I don't remember this at all, which is a good thing. I think the footage that they were showing on the news is probably pretty disturbing.
I have very, very like vague memories of seeing some of that stuff on mm-hmm. the TV. And sadly,
really?
My memories are almost not like, oh my gosh, this is horrible. It was like, oh, this is the news. Like, this is just another night of the news,
yeah.
which just,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that was when news, I mean, it was Walter Cronkite. It was some of those mm-hmm. iconic TV anchors, and I can kind of hear his voice, but I do have this feeling of like, huh. Like, that's whatever.
Wow,
it wasn't like unusual to me. Because when you think about it, my whole memory of TV watching, when I really start remembering it, that would have been when? It would have been when yes. the war yeah. was going on.
Yes.
And, you know, the news was always on our TV. It's not like my mom ran and turned it off when that kind of stuff was on. Mm-hmm. So that really makes me sad now that I'm thinking
that's really,
about it.
And that, I was going to say that I don't have memories of that. But now that you say that, if you had asked me to conjure a picture of the news in my mind when I was 6 years old, that's what I would have conjured. And so I guess I do have memories of it.
This is the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite.
1974 really began to reflect this changing world around us. So it's offering both escapism, social commentary, and these opportunities for some family drama. And if you guys remember on our, I'm not sure what episode it would have been, but we talked about the TV pilots, which were often TV movies of the week. And mm-hmm. that's how these networks gauge whether or not shows would be successful. So some of the shows we're going to talk about today had pilots that maybe aired at the end of 1973, and they had huge ratings, and they're like, yes, bingo. And we'll talk about some of those shows.
Mm-hmm. And this is kind of also, on that note, this is also a year of spinoffs.
So, mm-hmm. you know, they kind of knew what was working. Don't fix it.
Yeah.
Right?
That's right.
Yeah. So, you guys, right now, it is time to celebrate the golden anniversary of some of our favorite shows.
I feel like a grandma right now. The golden anniversary of shows that I watched when they started.
That's right. Let's start with the shows that have endured. They have a lasting legacy, whether it was their timeless themes like friendship and family, or maybe it was that groundbreaking storytelling that pushed the boundaries of television, or those characters that wove their way into our hearts. Mm. These shows often reflected and shaped the culture zeitgeist at the time, making them significant cultural touchstones, even to us today. And mm-hmm. so let's discuss some of those, what I would call legacy TV shows.
From Television City in Hollywood.
Good Times was developed by Norman Lear as a spinoff of Maude, which itself was a spinoff of All in the Family.
And I had forgotten about that.
Yes.
By the way.
This is a spinoff. Mm-hmm. And Good Times was television's first African-American two-parent family sitcom. It Whoa. Has a place in our history.
Wow.
So it premiered in February of 1974. It was a mid-season show. And during its first full season on the air, the show was the seventh highest rated in the Nielsen ratings. In its first full season, the 75-76 season, it was one of three shows that focused on the lives of African Americans. Which, remember, we didn't have siloing the way that we do today. So these weren't, quote unquote, black shows.
Right.
These were just shows.
Right.
That mm-hmm. we all watched. Everybody watched them. This was entertainment. This was family programming. So the characters originated on Maude were Florida and Henry Evans, not James, with Florida employed as Maude's housekeeper. But do you remember where Maude lived?
Did she live in New York somewhere? Like
she did. She lived in Tuckahoe. Well, let's just say it's not Chicago, right? It's not in Chicago. And Henry, not James, was a New York City firefighter. So when they decided to feature the Florida character in her own show, they changed the characters to fit a new series that was already in development rather than start from scratch, even though that meant changing their black middle class family into a poverty stricken lower class family. Henry becomes James, and he wasn't a firefighter. Instead, he worked various odd jobs, and they lived in Chicago. And there was no mention of Maude ever. So I guess all they kept was the name Florida.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say, why did they just change your name?
Yeah, it doesn't have to be Florida. I mean, if we just like her, let's just have a show starring her.
Yeah.
So this new story, this new show focuses on Florida and James Evans and their family in a public housing project in a poor black neighborhood in inner city Chicago. We all know this, right? The project is never named on the show, but the opening and closing credits show actual footage of Cabrini Green. So we can make some assumptions, right? Mm-hmm. And when the series begins, JJ... We all know JJ, right? JJ is 17, and he's portrayed by 26-year-old Jimmy Walker, who was 8 years younger than John Amos, who played James.
Oh, my gosh.
He's 8 years younger than his dad.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Then there's Thelma, the smart one. She's 16. And Michael, the socially conscious one, is 11. Then there's Florida's best friend, Willona. We all love Willona. Yes. And she was a recent divorcee who worked at a boutique. And this, FYI, is where I learned the word boutique.
Oh.
I also learned the word wino from Good Times. Do you remember that? There were two winos. There were two winos on Good Times. There was Ned the Wino, who models for JJ's painting of Black Jesus. And I can't remember the other wino. There was another one. So Good Times was intended to be a very timely show focusing on the social problems of the day, much like All in the Family. And this was the reason that both Esther Rolle and John Amos signed on to the project. They were excited to be a part of this. Both expected the show to deal with very serious topics in a comedic way, like All in the Family, while providing, and this is very important, while providing positive characters for viewers to identify with. But then JJ happened.
Yeah.
He was the breakout character. He was an immediate success with viewers, mostly due to his enthusiastic delivery of Dynamite! Dynamite became his catchphrase, and it got such big laughs that the director required it to be in every single episode.
Oh, yeah. I look forward to it. Like, when is he going to say it? Honestly, yeah. Like, this is a perfect
time. Yes. Yes. So because of Dynamite, the writers focused more on JJ's antics instead of the serious issues that Esther Rolle and John Amos wanted to, and they got more and more annoyed. It was also not the kind of depiction of Black people that Esther Rolle had wanted to provide for viewers. And she was very vocal about it. And she actually said in a 1975 interview with Ebony magazine, this is her quote, "He's 18 and he doesn't work. He can't read or write. He doesn't think. The show didn't start out to be that. Little by little, they have made JJ more stupid and enlarged the role. Negative images have been slipped in on us through the character of the oldest child."
Yeah.
John Amos was actually fired after season 3 because of these disagreements. And I'm just assuming this here because I don't actually know, but I'm assuming that there were no Black people on the producing or writing staff to actually who could really understand what John Amos was fighting for, right? And the producers decided not to recast him, but they killed him. They killed him off. Seriously?
That's not something you do on a sitcom.
Sitcom. Right. Com is comedy. Sitcom. Yeah. You kill the dad? Right. That's not.
Yeah, that's funny. That's a downer.
And then by the end of season four, Esther Rolle was out too, by her own choice. And they made up some cockamamie story about Florida dating some dude who has lung cancer and they have to move to Arizona for his health. I swear to God. So now there were no parents on the show. Willona was the only parent, and she would, like, check in on the kids. That's how the show ended.
Also debuting in 1974.
Sunday, Monday, happy days. Tuesday, Wednesday, happy days. Thursday, Friday, happy days. The weekend comes, my cycle hums. Ready to race to you. These days are ours.
You guys, I love how the shows so far that we're starting with are Good Times, Happy Days. Like, right. You can see, but you can also kind of see, like what I was talking about earlier, ABC's really banking on America's craving for wholesome family broadcasting, right? And they found it in 1974, again, with Happy Days, which was born out of a vignette on one of our other favorite shows, Love American Style.
For me and you.
Yes. What was the word you learned from Love American Style, Kristen?
A nightcap. Nightcap. Did you want to come in for a nightcap?
Yeah.
Here, put it on your head.
That was the show that I swear I have zero idea how I was allowed to watch it at a young age, but I loved it and I felt so naughty. I didn't understand half of what was happening, but I knew that it was like adult.
Right.
So Happy Days aired for 11 seasons and 255 episodes. And as we all know, firmly staked a claim in television history. As well as the hearts of all of us Gen X, who were lucky enough to be there for all of it. Regardless of if I was watching it in 1974 or not, I know all the episodes from season one still too. Listeners, if you loved Happy Days and you want to hear us chat a lot more about its evolution, we have a great episode devoted to it. It's episode 82, and it's called These Happy Days Are Yours and Mine. And I don't know about you guys, but it's one of my favorite conversations we've had because Happy Days was not simply a favorite show of mine, but it was really a very impactful one in my coming of age, which I talk a lot about in that episode. You guys are nodding. You remember that. And we all have really special, and I would say meaningful stories associated with Happy Days that we all share in that episode. So listeners, go back to episode 82. Yeah, I would say there's two or three shows that I'm the most grateful for 1974 spawning. And Happy Days is definitely one of those three.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it went for so long that it was a part of so many people's childhoods.
Right. I think you guys remember that I shared in that episode that I felt the death of my childhood, in quotation marks, was the night that I watched the series finale.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about.
Yeah. That was your story. That was super
So it really defined my childhood, I would say, in terms of television.
The whole thing. Yeah. The whole childhood.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. It was all-encompassing.
Yeah.
It was so important to us because all of those characters were growing up alongside us. A show that's on that long, you got to watch these characters truly go from young either children or young teens, tweens, to adults. Another show that was definitely a reflection of the culture and the times, but I'm going to go on the record of saying is not really enduring as far as could it work today, and that's Chico and the Man.
Things will be better. Oh, yes, they will. For Chico and the Man. Yes, they will. For Chico and the Man.
And I love this show so much.
Did you?
Did
you love it, Kristen? Mm-hmm. I do have memories of watching this show again, like I always say, probably at my dad's house. Chico and the Man aired on NBC for four seasons from September of 1974 to July of 1979, and it starred Jack Albertson as Ed Brown, or the man, who was a cantankerous and quite racist widower, and he was the owner of a rundown garage in East Los Angeles. And then the beautiful Freddie Prinze was Chico.
Oh, so beautiful.
Mm-hmm. So beautiful. And you guys, I went back and watched a couple episodes last week. The costume person on that show just hit it out of the park with him.
With the jeans?
He is the tight jeans. Mm-hmm. The tight jeans. And I mean, I'm talking in front and back.
Yep.
And the silky shirts and maybe with a silky scarf tied around his neck.
Oh, the scarf. The mustache.
Was so 70s. I know. And the mustache.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I think I didn't know what sexy was, but I was responding to the sexiness.
Of course you were. You were 40. You were 35.
I was 35 in 1974.
Anyway, so Freddie Prinze, obviously he's Chico, who is an optimistic young Mexican-American who comes in originally looking for a job. Did you guys know of Cheech and Chong's connection to this show?
No.
Okay, this is so interesting. I learned this last week as well. So they say that the series creator followed Cheech and Chong on tour for 3 months, and he based this whole show on a couple of their skits. And I guess he actually asked them, Cheech and Chong, to be part of the show, but they declined, saying they wanted to stick to movies. So this is apparently, probably a lot of listeners are going, yeah, we knew that. So we didn't know this, yeah. Mm-mm. I think that's, but I can see the influence, can't you? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So I want to go back to the thing I just said earlier. Is this a show that could work today? I think we all can agree, no, because of the man's, because of, you know, Ed's constant use of ethnic slurs. Mm-hmm. It's a very racist show. I was watching, like I said, I watched a couple episodes. And I know we talk about this a lot, listeners, in some of our other episodes, but like, movies that don't work today because they stay firmly in what life in our culture was like and what was acceptable in the 70s. And I will say, I found myself laughing at a couple and then felt terrible. Oh. Not laughing, like, bah-ha-ha. It was a funny line that was written, but then I was like, oh, like, no.
Yeah, like, we're not supposed to laugh at that.
No, no. Yeah. Or 180 degrees from that, like, as the words were coming out of his mouth, I just kind of wanted to turn it off. I was like, oh no, geez. This is making me very uncomfortable. Yeah, just shaming lots of different types of people.
Much like Archie Bunker, I think the racism was the point in that they were trying to shine a light on it. And yet we were laughing, but now we live in an era in which it's not acceptable to say things out loud, but they were exposing it. But then did it also normalize it? I mean, it's all confused. It's very confused.
I will say, though, it made me realize and grateful for how far we've come since then, because I got to thinking, these people were sitting in the writer's room, or I don't know how many writers there were, but they were intentionally writing these things for him to say to get laughs. And it's a live studio audience, because it's another one of the shows that when he walks in at the beginning, it's very awkward now to watch it because we don't have shows like this anymore. He walks in, he makes his entrance, be it Ed or Chico. They walk in and they have to hold their pose and kind of do this kind of awkward staring at each other while the studio audience stops screaming and clapping and everything. Like one episode in particular, Chico walks in, he's coming back from vacation and he's got his tennis racket. And the crowd goes so nuts that he stands there for like a full like 20 seconds and he's just kind of swinging his tennis racket. And I feel like that had to have been so awkward for him as an actor to have to hold those moments. Tragically, we all know that Freddie Prinze shot himself in January of 1977, which was during the third season. The last episode to star him was called Ed Talks to God. Isn't that weird?
Oh, wow.
And was taped just several hours earlier.
Oh, God, I just got goosebumps.
Mm-hmm. Oh. I don't know.
There were only 3 episodes left in season 3. So they just had other characters comment that Chico had gone to Mexico to visit his father to finish out season 3. And then in season 4, they do replace him, but with a 12-year-old Mexican orphan named Raul. And in season 4, they do mention Chico a handful of times. And in a 2-part episode, I read this because I didn't watch it at the time. There's a 2-part episode where Raul finds Chico's things in a closet, and Ed finally breaks down and tells him that Chico is dead.
Oh.
Heartbreaking, right? And they tried some other things in season 4. They brought in Charo as an aunt. Yeah. You know, they tried to do some things, but obviously it's not working. And also the whole series is now shrouded in just so much sadness and so much.
He's the title character.
It's in the title. Right. It's shocking to me that they would even consider keep going. That's shocking to me.
Go back and watch if you haven't in a long time. Gosh. Freddie Prinze, he leaps off the screen at you. He's so full of life. He's so enigmatic in a way. Like he had that it factor.
Yeah, he really did.
And so I feel like if he left the show, it'd be one thing if they tried to keep going. But because of the circumstances surrounding it, you have to just
Even if he had died in another manner, you could maybe consider going on in doing that sort of goodbye type of show. Mm-hmm. But the way in which he died, it illuminates how we treated suicide in the 70s, which was more like a crime and an embarrassment as opposed to the tragedy that it is. And, you know, you even think about how people would say things like, oh, my God, I'm going to kill myself, or, you know, holding the pretend gun to your head. If I see people do that today, it feels so out of place. It feels so anachronistic. It's not something to take lightly at all. And I think people did take it lightly because it was something that somebody did to themselves, which we know is not true.
Exactly.
Right. It's not true. And so I'm just so disgusted that they kept going, that they kept, and that would never happen nowadays.
Especially, Kristen, with only 3 episodes left. It would have been so easy to just say, wow, out of respect for him, for his family, for the situation.
Yes.
The season's over.
Right.
The season's over.
It's just another example of, you know, it's about the profit and the money for a lot of these networks. Exactly. And it's not. It's not about feelings and the right thing to do. It's, we have the successful show in the top whatever in the Nielsen ratings. We need to keep going. And that makes me sad. It makes me sad today that sometimes that's a choice that companies will make over the right thing to do necessarily. Mm-hmm.
And it's so interesting now that I'm thinking about when I got that news, so much of the explanations that I got for things like that came from one person. And it was my cool aunt. The cool aunt who would talk to me about things. The cool aunt who did tell me that Sonny and Cher were getting divorced.
Right? That Buffy didn't get hit by a car.
That Buffy didn't get hit by a car. Right. She also told me about Freddie Prinze. And she was serious. It's not that she wasn't serious, but she told me as if I was an adult. mm-hmm. as opposed to trying to protect me from the truth. My parents never would have shared that with me, and they would have, where's Chico? Oh, I don't know. He's in the bathroom, right? They right. would have made something up.
And you know what's weird? Let's think of it. So 1977, I was 7 when this happened. I do have memories of learning that Freddie Prinze mm-hmm. had died. If you asked me before I did some research for this episode, I would have said it was a drug overdose. So I yeah. knew that there was something like, you know, self-inflicted about it. Mm-hmm. And I remember feeling like really like scared, you Aww. Know, like now that yeah. I'm thinking back on it, like I don't have great memories about it, but I'm feeling right now like I can remember feeling having a really bad feeling around it.
Yeah.
And so I must have somehow gotten that yep. news.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. I think it was maybe one of the first times I don't want to say I heard the word, but that I could like put the word with some person character that I knew in my head.
It was real.
It mm-hmm. was real. It was just all these really mixed emotions.
Yeah. Complicated and scary yeah, feelings for yeah, a child exactly. to have to right. someone they watched about.
And then the show keeps going. Like, how confusing must that have been for children turning on Chico and the Man?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Oh, and that the writers didn't think about that. The producers didn't consider that when they were saying, well, what should we do?
Right.
And so this is just another example of how we consider things today versus back in 1974, 1977, actually.
You guys, I'm just now thinking also how awful of them to just say he's in Mexico yes! visiting his father God. And brushing this very real thing and this very tragic, you know, event under the rug. And then as if that's not bad enough, you go through the whole summer. So kids that loved this show, especially young, you know, Mexican-American kids loving this show. And this is a Chico, Freddie Prinze is a, you know, someone they looked up to.
That's right.
Then let's start again in September, and oh, we're still saying he's in Mexico because that two-part episode doesn't come till later. We're still just ignoring the fact that Chico's not here, and here's this 12-year-old Mexican orphan who's going to bring, you know, let's bring in a cute little, you know,
haha,
you yeah. know, Cousin mm-hmm. Oliver in, yeah, basically.
It is. It's a Cousin Oliver.
So they're ignoring yeah. this. They're yeah. telling kids we don't talk about this, basically, yeah. and that's very mm-hmm. 1974 if you mm-hmm. think about it. We don't mm-hmm. talk about this. We're going to
gloss
brush
it
this over.
No big yeah. deal. No big deal. Mm-hmm.
Carolyn, is our next show going to lift us out of this?
I think so.
This is Jim Rockford. At the tone, leave your name and message. I'll get back to you.
The Rockford Files.
Okay, hotshot, who are you?
Emmy Award winner James Garner stars as Jim Rockford.
Back on the case, my regular rates.
Ex-con.
Graduate of San Quentin 7 years ago.
Turned private investigator.
I don't do anything dangerous.
With the habit of attracting the toughest cases.
There's a killer walking around.
And the biggest trouble.
Can't you just picture that show's opening, right?
Yes.
That iconic theme
goosebumps.
Song.
Yes.
Oh, remember, if you guys remember in our TV theme song episode, we talked about that song.
Yeah.
Mike Post,
yes,
our
absolutely.
TV theme
yes.
song patron saint. It reached the top 10 of Billboard's 100 and actually won a Grammy for Best Instrumental Arrangement. So that, just that opening is so memorable.
Yep. And every high school band through the 80s yeah. played it at halftime during the football game. And every high school cheerleader yeah. in the 80s has done a little, I've done so many little, you know, 8-count routines mm-hmm. to that. It's, or you hear it in the basketball, you know, when the basketball yep. game's going on. Yeah.
Yeah. And let's also say that we've talked about all of these shows have such memorable theme songs. Again, you know, we talk about today oh. and just the demise of the theme song and how that it's in and of yeah. itself, not even the characters, not even the plots of the shows, anything. Those theme songs can be such cultural touchstones for us. So mm-hmm. Hats off to Mike Post and that iconic theme song that lives on in our mind. And also, you guys, who could not love Jim Rockford? Okay,
yeah,
let's face
it's true.
It. He was not this bulky, serious, you know, private eye. He was witty. He could be both tough and vulnerable and often at the same time. Like, mm-hmm. he kind of wanted to be my uncle or something. That's how I felt about Jim Rockford.
Mm-hmm.
He was just really, really likable. And beyond that, I wanted – so we love Jim Rockford. What else from that show stands out in your memory as iconic?
The car.
Okay, we got the car. Yeah. Good job.
I always thought he was handsome.
Oh,
I
mean, for sure.
So handsome. Yes.
Even as a child. This was definitely not a show that we watched. I only know of Rockford Files just from it being an iconic show and everything. I don't know that I can truly say I've watched more than, you know, maybe two or three in my whole life, but it's so iconic that
yeah,
you know it.
But what, as far as like what else I remember besides the car, and again, I too was not a watcher of the show, which makes it a little confusing for me because what I'm, my answer to your next question is Mariette Hartley. Was she actually on the show or were they just in the camera commercials together?
I have a whole rabbit hole, as you can imagine, on Mariette Hartley.
But that would be a great one for an ads episode.
Yes, that's true.
So save it, yeah.
Do any of you remember kind of where you lived?
Oh,
where his little office was?
Oh, he was in a trailer park.
He lived in a trailer.
Yes, that's right.
That iconic trailer. Well, in my mind, it's iconic. And it was built on a soundstage, so it wasn't an actual, like, trailer they were filming in. And after the show ended, they actually used that trailer in other TV productions. And it got me wondering. You guys might not remember this, but in Champions of Love Story, one of the coaches, he lives in a trailer.
Yes.
For those who don't remember, Champions of Love Story was a movie of the week starring my celebrity crush and now friend, James Vincent McGinnigal. And I remember so much about that show. But yes, I also remember the trailer. And I'm wondering now,
could that trailer be the same trailer
as Rockford? I'm going to have to go back and maybe compare. This inside of this trailer was used on many TV productions because it was built on a soundstage. It's not a real trailer.
But you're right. The interior might be the same.
Don't you remember? It was so groovy.
Also, some fun facts about the Rockford Files. The show's writing is often credited with its success. And oftentimes, the writers would maybe run out of ideas. They would ask the crew. So they were like cameramen and maybe, you know, people that, what are they called? The craft people? Who are the people that do the
craft services.
They might have added some plot lines. But it's interesting to know that David Chase, who is the creator of The Sopranos, his first writing gig was on The Rockford Files.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, that's interesting. So that's what, 35 years prior? Yeah, or 30 years prior? Yeah.
So he worked hard to get up to that Sopranos.
Mm-hmm. It takes 30 years.
Yeah. Everybody remember that. But also, sadly, the show ended abruptly, actually, in the middle of its sixth season, because James Garner did a lot of his own stunts. He was known for enjoying doing his stunts, had fun doing them, but obviously they're going to take a toll on you physically.
Yeah.
So midway through the sixth season, he asks to take a leave of absence for some health reasons. And again, these corporate whatevers, Universal Studios gets a little bit annoyed and is like, that's not going to happen. And they have this like legal battle. And then they say, forget it. And they just cancel the show. They don't even give it like any kind of an ending. It just ends.
It just stops.
Yeah. We don't get another fake Jim Rockford. We don't get some other actor cast in the in there or anything. And yeah. And that was sadly the end of that wonderful show.
Came to us in 1974. Rhoda came to us starting in 1974. Rhoda leaves Minneapolis and her beautiful apartment, the house that she shared with Phyllis and Mary Tyler Moore, and she leaves her job as a window dresser at Hempel's department store, and she moves back to New York City, where she gets re-enmeshed with her traditional Jewish family, including her mother, Ida Morgenstern, played by Nancy Walker, and her sister, Brenda,
played by
Julie Kavner, whose voice will forever be recognized as that of Marge Simpson. There will never be another voice more recognizable, I think, than Marge Simpson.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Brenda, a.k.a. Brenda.
Right.
Brenda Morgenstern. The other standout character, at least in my six-year-old mind, Carolina Chick, she's nodding her head so hard right now, is Carlton the Doorman, who you never saw, but you only heard on the intercom, always preceded by, "Hello, this is Carlton, your doorman," which we clearly thought was hilarious.
I loved it. I think even, I played Carlton the Doorman sometimes because we had an intercom in our house. It was so 70s. We had one of those new tone, you know.
And the funniest joke I wanted one of those in my house so badly. My friend Kristen had one.
And it was the joke for all the six-year-olds was when Rhoda would ring the buzzer and say, Carlton, and he'd say, hello, this is Carlton, your doorman. And we're like, she knows. She just said your name.
Yes.
This is Carlton, your doorman.
Yes, Carlton 1.
Well, and there we have another catchphrase, right?
Yes, we do. Yeah. Another 1974 catchphrase. So Carlton was voiced by Lorenzo Music, who was not an actor, but just a writer for the Mary Tyler Moore Show. But more importantly, that Carlton, your doorman voice got him the gig as the voice of Garfield. And that went on forever.
I did not know that.
That may be one of the most random facts we've ever
learned. He is Garfield. Carlton, your doorman, is Garfield.
Oh, my gosh.
So Rhoda was the first spinoff of the Mary Tyler Moore Show and made history in its first year when they broke ratings records with episode number 8. The one where sad single Rhoda finally gets married to Joe Girard. Rhoda was getting married.
I was so excited.
I know.
That was must-see TV for my family. That was like we all gathered around, probably popcorn.
Yes.
Yes.
And she was getting married before Mary. I mean, who'd have thunk, right? 52 million people tuned in to see this event, which was the highest rated TV episode of the 70s. It was second overall out of all TV episodes, second only to the I Love Lucy episode where little Ricky is born.
Wow.
Can you believe that? And we all remember what happens. Phyllis forgets to pick up Rhoda for her wedding, and she ends up running through the city in her wedding dress, riding the subway in her wedding dress. Carolyn is like Lucy.
I just watched that one maybe a year ago when we were doing research for something else. It's so classic.
I mean, you can hear the theme song and watch her, like you said, the crosswalk. She's running through the crosswalk in her wedding dress going, da-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na. We all know it, right? So did you know that CBS Studios was inundated with wedding gifts for Rhoda and Joe sent in by viewers?
I'm trying to think, is that just like cute? Are there people like
that? Oh, that's kind of weird though. I mean, they're living in a,
They went shopping. Think about that. They went shopping to pick out a gift
for Rhoda and Joe. That they were really getting married? I mean,
they had to go to the post office. Yes, they had to mail a package to CBS Studios. They went to Macy's or iMagnon or Donaldson's. Yeah, they got a place setting and they packaged it and they spent money to send it to CBS Studios. If everybody ask your mothers, if your mothers did this, we want to hear from you and I want to hear it because we knew these were fictional characters, right?
Yeah,
it could have been grandma's. So, unfortunately, the marriage was a quick one. It only lasted a couple of seasons, and then we watched Rhoda go through a divorce. And the show became about Rhoda being a single gal once again, right back where we started. Mm-hmm. And the creators did that on purpose because they were like, uh-oh, we've just given the audience exactly what they wanted, and now there's no comedy left. Rhoda has lost the thing that made her funny. But audiences did not agree. And post-divorce, the show started losing viewers, and they canceled it midway through its fifth season in 1978. It turns out that we were really happy for Rhoda, and we really wanted it to work out. And I remember being very tense during those divorce episodes. I mean, I have to give them credit for shining a light on what was happening in our culture at that moment. It was a very real thing that was happening, and showing the reality of it. That was a service. But I remember being very tense. I had just recently learned about divorce via the Sonny and Cher show. And I remember those scripted arguments between Rhoda and Joe. And I remember the moment in the middle of an argument when they decided that it was over, that they should get a divorce. It was very serious.
Yeah, it was. It was sad. I love David Grohl.
Yeah, with his curly hair. Yeah. Was it a perm? I think it was a perm.
Has to be. Hi, listeners. It's Michelle. And like all three of us here at the Pop Culture Preservation Society, I know a lot of you are experiencing many of the delightful symptoms that come with perimenopause and menopause. Ones people tell you, you just have to live with for years. But that is absolutely not true. And Carolyn, Kristen, and I are proof.
We all began taking Hormone Harmony several months ago and have truly noticed big improvements to things like menopause-related brain fog, shut up, we have, sleep quality, weight management, hot flashes, and our general moods and well-being. You guys, I've even weaned off the HRT patches I've worn for the past 6 years. Happy Mammoth, that's the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. And it isn't just for menopause. Any woman with symptoms of hormonal imbalances can take it. It has zero sugar and is gluten-free, dairy-free, non-GMO, and third-party tested. And the biggest benefit, feeling like myself again. That's what women mention over and over in their reviews, over 17,000 of them. Honestly, Hormone Harmony has become a phenomenon. A bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 seconds. And for a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com using the code PCPS at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code PCPS for 15% off today.
Hello, listeners. If you've been listening for the past few months, you know that I've been experimenting with a new clothing rental membership from Armoire. After the pandemic, I fell into the routine of pretty much not getting dressed at all, ever. I basically had nighttime pajamas and daytime pajamas, and it was a habit that was so hard to break when it was time to start leaving our houses again. Was I comfortable? Yes. But did I look like me? Not really. That's where I thought Armoire might be helpful for me. Armoire makes getting dressed easy. My membership has helped me build a better wardrobe with brands that are high quality, unique, and look a lot more like me than my pajamas did. Is comfort still a priority? 100%. That's one of the things I'm learning as I experiment with new styles. There are clothes out there that feel like pajamas, but I still look like I got dressed in the morning. All you have to do is take a 5-minute style quiz and select items from your dynamic personalized closet. The styles show up at your door in as little as 2 days. Then, when you're ready for new clothes, just swap them out for more new-to-you styles. Right now, our listeners can give Armoire a try and get up to 50% off their first month. That's up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/PCPS. That's armoire.style, armoire.style/PCPS, to get up to 50% off your first month and never worry about what to wear again. Try Armoire today.
Of course, like Mary and Rhoda, these were these strong women characters that we kind of grew up knowing, kind of not necessarily knowing another way, kind of that second wave feminism that you referred to, Kristen. And that flows into our next show that's celebrating its 50th anniversary. And actually, I really loved this show. We are talking about Police Woman. This is Angie Dickinson as Sergeant Pepper Anderson. Did I
Pepper
say Angie?
Anderson.
Yeah, Angie Dickinson.
I love
that
name, Pepper.
I did too, Pepper.
I feel like I named my Barbies when I would play Pepper.
She was big on going undercover. You know, she was always like, she might be a prostitute or something like that. She could take on a lot of different characters that obviously a male couldn't take on. But this is one of the first police drama shows that had a female lead character, okay?
Oh, wow.
I know.
That's kind of shocking.
So Angie Dickinson, she got that role, you guys, when she was in her 40s. Okay.
Oh, I did not know that.
She's defying age and beauty standards at the time, not to mention her character, which is defying standards that we have come to know in television. Okay. So the show tackles some really serious issues of the time. It tackles sexism, discrimination. There's domestic violence, drug abuse, all of those social issues that are affecting us at the time. Angie Dickinson, Pepper Anderson, is taking care of. If you remember, her superior was a male. And he has great roller skating skills. That would be Earl Holliman. And if you are wondering why we know that, he takes a few spins around the disco roller rink in the Chips disco episode.
Oh, yes. And someday we're going to do an episode on.
Yes.
Someday.
Earl Holliman. Down the middle. Remember, there's like the announcer on the episode announcing who it is? Melissa Sue Anderson and
Victor French.
Victor French. Oh, Brenda Vaccaro and
yes,
Ruth Buzzy.
But Victor, I don't think, has roller skates on. Somebody doesn't.
Oh, God, I hope
I think
not.
Victor just tries to
Ruth
like.
Buzzy. I think Ruth Buzzy is just like in her socks.
And then she's like a foot shorter than everybody.
Oh, guys, I'm sorry. That will
It's truly
never
though, like they pair people up where it's like Ruth Buzzy and Todd Bridges.
This is we're gonna do this episode someday, and this is what the episode's gonna be. Yes, you making announcements and us laughing.
Oh my goodness. But for us Gen Xers, you guys, this show really helped shape our views on gender equality and women's roles in society. And the show is actually credited with the increase in women pursuing careers in law enforcement.
Oh, sure.
Yes. Wow. And when some sociologists have done research and they've interviewed women that are in the field currently, a majority of those women cite this show as being a factor as to why they went into the field of law enforcement.
Okay, I just got goosebumps.
Talk about having a lasting impact.
Right.
No kidding.
Exactly. Yeah. And we've talked about, I think we talked about this before in our Charlie's Angels episode, but policewomen kind of laid the groundwork that females could have these lead roles and be in, you know, detective work, police work. They could have these police dramas that focused on females. And so, yeah, we have Sergeant Pepper Anderson to thank for the a lot of the females that are in
for
the field
Charlie's
today.
Angels, for Cagney and Lacey, for Rizzoli and Isles, which is, you can add that to one of my dad's favorite shows. It's The View and the Waltons and Rizzoli and Isles.
Yeah.
Find it.
And he appreciates strong women. Don't
oh,
we love
he does.
That? Well,
yes,
he had
he
to
does.
If he has Kristen as a daughter, right? He's either like sink
child.
Or swim.
Yeah, right.
And last fun fact, was one of Gerald Ford's favorite shows.
Oh.
And once Gerald Ford rescheduled a press conference so he could watch Policewoman.
Because that was the old
That's
time he could
awesome.
Watch it.
Right. Exactly.
Yes. Exactly.
Right.
He can't stream it.
That's right.
He can't record
can't
it.
Can't record it.
I can't do this press conference right now.
Sorry, everyone. Sorry,
Policewoman is on.
Right. Policewoman is on. That could be one of the best fun facts you've ever had.
Well, thank you very much.
That's a good one.
These shows left a lasting legacy in many ways. But sadly, there were some shows that didn't make it past one season.
Not at all.
Although they might have left some lasting legacies as well. And we're going to talk about some of those right now.
These shows did not leave a lasting legacy because only Carolyn and I remember them, but they did leave a lasting impression on us.
I'm going to represent all of you listeners who have never heard of these shows.
This show, lasting impact for me from the kind of house I wanted to live in when I grew up. We are talking Apple's Way. Okay.
Oh, I loved it so much.
And there's reasons that Kristen and I love this so much. Mm-hmm. And I would say we bonded over this because one of our favorite TV writers, producers of all time, wrote this show.
Earl Hamner.
Yes, Earl Hamner.
Shut up. I, honest to God, did not know this was an Earl Hamner show.
Yes.
I didn't know.
I just guessed.
Yes.
No one. Oh, you guessed that?
Well,
no
I was thinking of who bonded
it.
You guys.
Yes, we
bonded
over
Earl
Hamner.
Earl Hamner.
Mm-hmm. I mean, she had me at Earl Hamner and Apple's Way. I mean, those were the two things where Kristen and I knew that we were going to be together forever because
we're going to get married.
Fondness for Earl and Apple's Way. So, you guys, Apple's Way, for those of you who might not remember this wonderful show, it starred our dear friend, and I can say that honestly now because she is our dear friend, Christy McNichol. This was one of her first dramatic roles, and she was little. She was a little girl.
I love
so
little
cute.
Christy McNichol. This is pre-family, right?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Oh,
very
sorry,
pre-family.
Long
really little, because the first season of Family, she's just a little nugget.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, this is pre-nugget. I mean, she is super little. And it follows the Apple family as they leave fast-paced Los Angeles and their lives there for a quieter existence in the small town of Appleton, Iowa. Now, hold on. I'm just learning that their name was Apple. Oh, that's right, because the town, I think, was named after their family. Like, this is the family, like, had this.
Yes.
Yeah, they had this lasting legacy in Iowa.
Already, just the things you've said, this is a show I would have loved. This is a show I have to find. So this
you
is going to be Carolyn. I'm going to give this mission to you. Find out where I can watch it. Thank you.
I will do that.
I remember asking my mom, because I was so fascinated with the fact that their last name was Apple. That was very endearing, right? Mm-hmm. And then the wife would call the husband Apple. I'm like, but his last name is Apple. And my mom would say, sometimes we call each other by our last names. And so she would call him Apple. Her husband.
Well, I don't remember that as much, Kristen, but what I do remember is where they lived. Okay?
Oh, I keep going, oh, I'm so sorry. I apologize. I got to stop
doing
that.
That's okay, because who didn't want to live in a converted gristmill? I don't know who didn't because
it had
I
a water
did
wheel.
That. Yes, it had a water wheel.
Yes.
It was
I
the
wanted
coolest
it.
Thing.
Yes.
And if I'm not mistaken, it. Kristen, wasn't he an architect?
Yes, he was an architect, yes.
Oh. And he designed their house. So this is Ronnie Cox, if you guys all remember Ronnie Cox.
He designed the gristmill?
Well, he designed how to convert it into a house.
Into a beautiful house that I wanted very badly.
It was kind of like it felt like a treehouse to me because didn't you have to go up the stairs to get there? And they
and
would
it was
like,
kind of on a farm.
Yeah,
type
and they
of property.
Eat outside a lot, kind of like they did on Parenthood.
Yes, they did. Well, yeah. I don't think either one of you mentioned that house in our TV Homes episode.
We did it.
Look at their faces. Both of them are like so
are you
shocked.
Sure? I'm going to have to go back and maybe
go back
to
that was a big one. That was maybe the first time I was like, I want a house with a water wheel. I got
to
have one.
I guess they expected it to last for more than one season because Kristen owns a lunchbox. They had merch. Mm-hmm. Apple's Way had merch.
There it is.
I think they had high hopes for it. I know Earl Hamner did. He was very sad that it ended. He did say that it was a wonderful, warm show. It was a show that dealt with real problems and real people, but was a victim of its time. And I think part of that was the shows it went up against. And it got switched around a lot. I think it maybe had some different time slots, but I found out that it had to compete with the Mary Tyler Moore Show sometimes, Nanny and the Professor, which we know Kristen enjoyed that show, and Sanford and Son. So it was probably hard for it to find a audience that stuck with it, but we stuck with it. They had family values. We had the small town America being portrayed. It was almost nostalgic in some ways. We talk about the throwback to some of our, you know, Happy Days, some of those shows. But the good news is I do believe we can find it, and I will put where you can find it in our show notes, because it has developed a cult following.
It has?
Oh, good.
I'm so happy to hear that. Everybody needs to try it. Everybody needs to try it, and then everybody weigh in and tell us what you think of Apple's Way.
Please. And I think you'll recognize a lot of the people that not only star in it, but that are also guest stars. So enjoy Apple's Way.
The next show that lasted for only a season that nobody has heard of except for me and my brother. I think so. The show was called Dirty Sally, which that alone makes me, I laugh when I just say Dirty Sally.
I'm trying, is it a Western or is she a motorbike rider?
Well, let me tell you, Carolyn. I was just about to say right now, everybody pause your listening devices and I want everybody to come up with three different possible scenarios that this show is about.
And that matters, and I'll tell you why in a bit. So this was a show that only aired for 14 episodes in 1974, but somehow made a huge splash at my house. And my brother, seriously, he would have been 3 years old, and I was six, but we were huge fans, so clearly we had no limits on our screen time. So Dirty Sally was exactly that. She was a bedraggled old crone with a dirty mouth who dressed in rags and had a mule named Worthless who wore a hat.
Wait.
I'm sold. Right? A mule with a hat?
She had a mule. She was dirty and had a mule named. Oh my God.
She had a mule. And that mule wore a hat. And I am all in. If you have a pet mule with a hat, I mean, what? I'm going to be there. So someone described her as a crusty old junk collector, which is, I think that's accurate. She had a rat's nest of wiry gray hair, a face all wrinkled up like a prune, and she sounded a little bit like Granny from the Beverly Hillbillies.
Tell me the actress who played her, because I'm going to post a picture of Dirty Sally in the Weekly Reader.
It will Husker Du people like crazy, because I saw it and I had not thought of Dirty Sally since 1974. My brain came out my ear. My brother and I would play Dirty Sally all the time.
I was going to ask, did you play it?
Yes, we did.
Did you make your brother be the mule? Did you put a hat on his head and ride him around?
I don't actually remember. That's a really good question. I'll have to ask him. So what I didn't know until 2 days ago is that Dirty Sally was a spinoff of Gunsmoke. I had no idea. No idea. Dirty Sally had guest starred on a handful of episodes of Gunsmoke, and they got truckloads of mail from viewers after every episode with Dirty Sally. People loved her and her mule with a hat. Well, so they gave
they
her
call
her own
Sally,
show.
Or do they call her Dirty Sally?
They call her Dirty Sally.
Oh, see, that's so 74.
Dirty Sally. Yeah. The ad for Dirty Sally in the TV Guide describes it like this. New show. Take a scrappy old dame. Team her with a young ex-gunfighter. I don't remember the gunfighter, but he was played by Dak Rambo, who you might remember from Dallas and All My Children.
Yeah.
Amongst other things, right?
Oh, totally.
Turn them loose, helping troubled folks in the turbulent West. And you've got a delightful, lighthearted new series from the creators of Gunsmoke. Dirty Sally is good, clean fun.
I see what they did there.
Yes. Oh.
Get it?
Oh, gosh.
But despite all of the fan mail that Dirty Sally got on Gunsmoke, and my brothers and my undying love for her, and the Emmy nomination for Jeanette Nolan, who played Dirty Sally, no joke. What? The show only lasted one half of one season.
Aww.
It is so weird that something can be so fleeting and so memorable at the same time. They even had a Dirty Sally character in the Ice Capades show that I went to that year.
No. Okay.
Yes, they did.
What?
It was like the Demolition Derby version of the Ice Capades. That's what it was. And when we saw Dirty Sally, we lost our minds. But you know what? Even as much as we loved her, I guess other people didn't love Dirty Sally as much as they loved Sanford and Son, which is the show that it was up against. So another show that was a victim of Sanford and Son. But also, pop culture historian Dave Sundstrom, who has a YouTube channel, you guys have maybe come across him, he has another theory. He thinks the name Dirty Sally made people think this was some kind of adult entertainment. And I think he might be right.
Well, when did Dirty Harry come out?
Oh, yeah. When did Dirty Harry? That's a good question. I'm guessing Dirty Harry was like 73.
Okay.
Could that be right?
I don't know that in 74 I would have thought, is this a motorcycle movie? But yeah, those were my two thoughts, that there was a lot of dust, and so it was a Western, or she's riding a motorcycle.
And she looked like a prune. So I could not watch Dirty Sally this week for research, because there is no video evidence of its existence on anywhere on the internet, which is rare. You guys, you can find everything. But there is someone who recorded the show with his little Panasonic tape recorder, you know, like you did when you were a kid, when you just recorded it because you wanted to listen to it.
Yes.
Yes, like you recorded the Fitzpatricks. So somebody did that, like we all did, and he put that audio on YouTube, which is like a testament to his childhood for all of us to enjoy. It's mostly like me, but your dad going friend. Oh, you the new murder. I mean, but that's all there is of Dirty Sally.
Oh,
I need to mention one other show that falls into the crime fighting, whodunit, private investigator, detective show that started in 1974. I'm going to blow your mind right now. This was really one of the most important additions to the new fall lineup in 1974, and that was Hong Kong Phooey. Another show that came to us thanks to the year 1974. It is the much beloved and casually racist Hong Kong Phooey. Hong Kong Phooey was a Hanna-Barbera cartoon. It was voiced by Scatman Crothers. Do you remember, okay, by the way, do you remember when Scatman Crothers was on the Love Boat and he taught Julie McCoy how to play the spoons? Do you remember that?
I think so, yeah, I think so.
Now that you say that. Staring at me.
I know the name Scatman Crothers. I wouldn't have known he was a spoon playing.
Oh, no, wait, maybe it wasn't the spoons. It was like the ham bone. Oh, yes, he taught her to do the ham bone. Okay, I'm evolving. Yep, and she thought she was so cool, but she wasn't. Okay, anywho, Hong Kong Phooey was a dog who masqueraded as a janitor until his superhero skills were called upon, at which point he would jump in the bottom drawer of a file cabinet and pop out the top drawer of the file cabinet dressed as a kung fu fighter. Hong Kong Phooey.
Yes.
So it also only lasted one season. No, not even one season. It aired, you guys, this is crazy. It aired from September to December 1974. That's it.
Gosh.
16 episodes. But in children's programming, that doesn't matter. Because it gets rerun ad nauseum and through the 80s.
Because it had a lunchbox too.
Listen.
Yeah.
Yes, and because anytime we post on social media Saturday morning cartoons and I need to find images and I'm Googling, you know, cartoons of the 70s, Hong Kong Phooey is right up there with the Scooby-Doos and the Looney Tunes. And so that's really interesting to me.
Yes. Well, remember Hong Kong Phooey, he drives a Phooey-mobile, which can turn into a plane or a boat, whatever you need. And he often has to consult his correspondence course manual on Kung Fu to know how exactly he should fight the current crime of the moment. Yeah, he had a correspondence course on Kung Fu, and then he becomes a superhero, like a quasi-racist superhero.
Yeah.
There are a lot of like sort of things that we thought were acceptable back in the 70s that are not. And Hong Kong Phooey was one of those things.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, talk about taking Asian stereotypes and putting them on a dog.
Phooey, number one super guy. Hong Kong Phooey, quicker than the human eye. She's got style, a groovy smile, and a vibe that just won't stop. When the joint gets rough, he's super tough with a Hong Kong fooey chop.
Okay, so there's another show in this sort of the same vein as Hong Kong Phooey that lasted a lot more than just 16 episodes. It was so long-lasting that it actually got turned into a movie, and that is Shazam! Oh, I loved Shazam.
He was so
cute.
But
you guys, I am so confused, because the show is called Shazam, and I, until yesterday, thought that was the superhero's name. I thought he was named Shazam. But no, Shazam is just the word that the kid says to turn into Captain Marvel. Am I the only one who is surprised by this?
I knew his name wasn't Shazam, but I don't remember what. I knew he turned into a superhero, but I would have not remembered what his name was.
This is what Wikipedia says. The program was about Billy Batson, a teenage boy who can transform into the superhero Captain Marvel by speaking the magic word Shazam. With his guardian named Mentor, which is kind of creepy, Billy travels the country in a 1973 Dodge Open Road motorhome looking for injustices to resolve.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. I, till yesterday, thought his name was Shazam.
I did too, till you're just telling me that.
Thank you.
Well,
I'm so glad.
Don't you remember, wasn't it the Shazam Isis Hour?
Yes, in 1975, it turned into the Shazam Isis Hour, and that included The Secrets of Isis, which was about an ancient Egyptian superheroine resurrected in the body of a schoolteacher.
Right, and wasn't her name Isis?
Yeah, her name was Isis.
So that's probably why I thought his name was Shazam.
Shazam and Isis.
Yeah.
Yes. But I have to read you some of the episode synopses that were on Wikipedia, because you will just die. This is something I've never seen before. It lists the premise of the episode, followed by the moral. Like, moral, colon. Literally, moral, colon. Okay, so for instance, in episode one called The Joyriders, a young man must figure out what to do when his friends insist on stealing cars and going on joyrides. Mm. Moral, colon. It is important to do what you know is right and not get conned into doing something dumb just because somebody calls you names. Here's episode two, which I totally remember, and you'll know why. It's called The Brothers. Chad is a blind boy who is being overly protected by his older brother, Danny. Chad feels so useless that he decides to run away. And when his brother goes after him, Danny gets bitten by a rattlesnake.
No!
Yes!
I think I remember that too!
Chad gains self-confidence after he is able to make it back to Billy, a.k.a. Shazam. Okay, but you got moral, colon. Moral, colon. Everyone needs a helping hand. People with problems or handicaps can get along almost as well as any of us. All they need is a chance to gain self-confidence.
I think the moral should be always wear hiking boots when you run away.
Episode three is called Thou Shalt Not Kill.
Ooh,
this is a children's show. Okay, sure. Thou Shalt Not Kill. When a woman dies, okay, there should be no dying in children's programming. Leaving instructions in her will to destroy her horse.
No.
To kill her horse, her niece tries to stop it. Captain Marvel and Mentor must help her save the horse while working within the law. Moral, colon. Today, you saw how someone tried to solve their problem by breaking the law instead of working within the law. It is important for us to remember that laws are made to help us and that when they stop helping us, they can be changed legally.
Wow.
It's so serious. But who in the writing room was like, okay, what if we have this woman die and then she wants someone to kill her horse?
Yes.
And then somebody's like, no, you can't kill the horse. I mean, what was happening?
It obviously left a lasting impact because, like you said, Kristen, they made a movie, right?
They made a movie.
Did either of you see Shazam in 2019?
No, but I do now remember in 2019 when the movie came out. I was very excited to see it because my sister and I were big Shazam fans.
Chosen from among all others by the immortal elders Solomon, Hercules, Atlas, Zeus, Achilles, Mercury, Billy Batson and his mentor travel the highways and byways of the land on a never-ending mission to right wrongs, to develop understanding, and to seek justice for all. In time of dire need, young Billy has been granted the power by the immortals to summon awesome forces at the utterance of a single word.
Shazam!
Well, in 2009, another one of our favorite Gen X Saturday morning shows that premiered in 1984, became a movie. I will tell you, though, I don't think the movie was as iconic as the television show was, because this television show's lasting impact is huge. And I would argue that has almost become more popular and has more of a cult following now than it did in 1974. And that is Land of the Lost.
Marshall, Will, and Holly
on a routine expedition.
The three of us were big Land of the Lost watchers slash fans. And man, talk about being stuck somewhere. The Marshalls might have been stuck in the Land of the Lost, but this show is stuck firmly in the 70s. You guys see what I did there?
Yeah, I did.
Totally.
But in the best way, right? Like the sets, the storylines, the dialogue, the animatronic dinosaurs, the Sleestaks. It's so primitive and perfectly Croft Brothers 70s. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Land of the Lost, to refresh your memories, aired for 3 seasons. That's 43 episodes, and starred our friends, and truly our friends, Wesley Uhr and Kathy Coleman as brother and sister Will and Holly Marshall. Spencer Milligan as their papa, as Wesley still calls him. Philip Paley, Chaka. And Ron Harper as Uncle Jack Marshall came on in season 3. And we all know the crazy fun premise of the Marshall family, who was on just a little routine expedition in their yellow raft, plunged down a waterfall into a whirlpool, and found themselves trapped in a land full of dinosaurs, primate people called the Pakuni.
That's what Chaka alien, was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, an alien-like insect people called what?
Sleestaks.
The Sleestaks.
Oh, they were so scary.
My God. Like, honestly, mm-hmm. I think if you ask children of the 70s who were already watching it to name, you know, 5 things that, you know, on television that terrified you, Sleestaks comes up for everybody.
Yes, oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Number one.
And if you watch it now, it's hilarious that that's what scared us. But like I said, this show, it both mesmerized and scared the crap out of us 70s kids. And it's such a pop culture treasure that, like I said, in 2009, there was a feature film remake starring Will Ferrell.
We know that Will Ferrell made the movie Land of the Lost because he loved Land of the Lost. He has used Land of the Lost references in other movies that he's done. And there's one movie where he is Dr. Will and Holly. Like Marshall, Will, and Holly. Dr. Will and Holly.
God, about that, Kristen.
Which is so brilliant.
I never knew that. Mm-hmm. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, now I'm going to have to go watch all the Will Ferrell movies and see if I can pick up on that. Let's keep talking about some children's programming. The good news is this came out on DVD, so if you can't find it anywhere else, you can find The Partridge Family 2200 AD on DVD.
Oh, thank God.
Because, you know, again, it was kind of short-lived as well, but it lives on in DVD. Do you guys remember watching The Partridge Family 2200 AD?
Oh, yes. But probably in reruns. And it was like a mashup of The Jetsons and The Partridge Family.
100%.
Are you kidding me?
It originally...
Yeah. I have to. I actually was joking about Christmas list starts now. I'm actually getting my pen on court. I would be all over something like that.
Originally, the idea for this animated futuristic series was going to be the Jetsons kind of grown up. And Jane was going to be like a reporter for the whatever, you know, Stellar News or something. But they thought, why don't we look at following this popularity of this TV show called The Partridge Family and just supplant them here into 2200 AD. They're still going to be this musical group, and they're still going to have a manager, but they're also going to have like some funky alien like pets and things like that. So the original actors, Danny Bonaducci, Suzanne Croft, and Brian Foster, they voiced their original characters of Danny, Tracy, and Chris. Susan Day did 2 episodes where she was Lori, but then she was replaced. Isn't that sad? By a voice actor who was actually an original Musketeer and went on to voice characters in Josie and the Pussycats.
That's right. She did a lot of stuff.
We did not have any David Cassidy or Shirley Jones or anything like that.
Shocking.
Again, short-lived, but lucky friends, you can watch it on DVD and I will get that info to you. All right, you guys, drum roll, please.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Without a doubt, the most important show to debut in 1974, and maybe the most important show to debut at all while we were children, is Little House on the Prairie! so important to us personally that we have devoted several episodes to Little House on the Prairie. We have our Traumas on the Prairie, where we talk to our friend Raven Stone. We've got our interview with Pamela Bob about her series,
Living on a Prairie.
Fact, Pamela Bob is now kind of the host
of
the Little House podcast, Little House 50th year podcast. We have just a Little House on the Prairie episode. That was one of our, in our first season, that the three of us just talk about our love.
And, yes.
And our interview with Karen Grassley.
Two interviews with Melissa Gilbert.
Yes. Carolyn, you said that this probably is the most important show to debut in 1974. And you said it was, you know, maybe the most important for all of us Gen Xers that debuted when we were children. Even if you, like I said earlier, even if you were born in 1973 or you weren't born until 1976, you know this show, you love this show. Mm-hmm. Little House on the Prairie was such a warm and cozy place to fall, no matter what our childhoods were like.
Yeah.
Despite all the fires and the wolves and the blizzards and the creepy townsfolk, despite all that, it was this solid family that we all wanted to be a part of. We've heard from so many of you saying that they played Little House on the Prairie all the time with their siblings, that they had their parents. You know, my sister and I, my mom made us for Christmas one year, we had long nightgowns with the little nightcaps. Like she made us the nightcap that, yeah, that had the little elastic and the kind of the ruffle around it. We wanted to live with them. We wanted all of it. And I think that it was that, but also it was a show that had this really cool historical timeline and setting that we'd only read about if we'd read the books. And so it was also an imaginative escape for us. It wasn't like we could pretend. Mm-hmm. And we were all at ages where we still loved to play pretend. So we could pretend to be pioneer girls and everything. It was like a make-believe land in the best way. And I think that, you know, despite all the scary stuff, the core of that show was the love and the security of that family. And I think no matter what kind of family experience we were all having at the time, that was what we wanted.
Everybody wanted that. Yeah, everybody wanted that.
Mm-hmm. Right. And we talked about earlier in this episode about a lot of the shows in 1974 kind of making some social commentary. And this was a perfect example. While it was set back in these pioneer days, and we could relate to that, like you just said, Michelle, wanting to dress up and those kind of things and play Little House on the Prairie. They were also able to weave in some very topical, current social issues of the day. And we can remember the episodes. There's about racism. There's some about drug abuse, sexual
abortion.
Yes.
Yeah. Some of this is done extremely awkwardly.
Well,
nonetheless,
right?
Michael Landon figured out how to make this happen on the prairie.
Right. And we all bought it. And we knew that they were going to do the right thing because they had this moral compass. Mm-hmm. We have our fun, cute cards. What would Ma do? What would Pa do?
Yeah.
Truly, that I think when we were growing up, what would Laura do? Like that was kind of what guided us. They helped show us at a time where there were a lot of things going on, the right path to take, which I really appreciated.
They always took the right path.
Yeah. Right.
You can't have been a child in the 70s and not aspired to be part of that family or to just hold that family dear.
Right.
And if you didn't, you're a monster.
That's right. And speaking of family, I think so many of us watched it with our families. It had that intergenerational aspect to it where we've had listeners share that they watched it with their grandmothers. So people have these really special memories of this show with who they watched it with as well. One cool fact I discovered when I was researching for this episode today, and another reason I love Michael Landon, was that did you know Little House on the Prairie was the only show that continued in production during the 1980 actor strike and writer strike?
Well, how did they do that?
Well, I wanted to know that too. Little House managed to continue filming because Michael Landon, acting as a representative for NBC, negotiated separate contracts with both the Screen Actors Guild and the Writers Guild of America. And these agreements allowed the show to keep rolling while many other productions were shut down. And it's a remarkable achievement when it shows how dedicated he really was to keep the show going.
Wow.
How about that?
And that also shows what kind of power he had. He was an incredibly powerful person. He did everything in that show. He was the writer, director, creator, producer, actor, a negotiator, union representative. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, he did the whole thing.
He did. Mm-hmm. And he did it well.
This has been a wonderful anniversary party for 1974. There is so much to celebrate here. And so many of you listening were born in this momentous year of network TV. And if this is you, if you are a product of 1974, along with Little House on the Prairie and Hong Kong Phooey, congratulations to you. Welcome to your 50s. We three are proof that it can be one of the best decades of your whole life. If you're nervous about turning 50, or if you're not sure how you feel about it, please listen to us. This is big. You are entering the most autonomous decade of your life. There is heartbreak for sure. Where am I going with this? Holy shit. Children grow up. They leave the nest. Parents get older and they need extra care. But you are at the peak of your creativity and your freedom. It's your turn. When that clock ticks over to the big 5-0, grab it by the horns and say, it's my turn, bitches. Let's do this. Thank you so much for listening today. Happy birthday to everyone turning 50, and we will see you next time.
And if you've enjoyed this episode or any of our Pop Culture Preservation Society episodes, we would love for you to leave a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts, because those reviews and testimonials really help us rise in the algorithms and get our show exposed to more people. So we would really appreciate you taking the couple of minutes to do that.
And today's episode was brought to you by a few of our newest wonderful supporters on Patreon. Did you know that our patrons not only get lots of exclusive bonus videos and goodies every month, but also get a shout out at the end of our episodes? They do, because we cannot thank them enough for taking their support of our podcast to the next level and literally keeping the lights on, the mics on, the lights on, all of it around here. Yeah, so today's humongous thank yous are going out to Linda, Diane, Richard, Laura, Shannon, Jen, Teresa, Dawn, Pamela, Melissa, Rosa, Jenny, Susan, and Christy.
In the meantime, let's raise our glasses for a toast, courtesy of the cast of Three's Company. And I don't think it's a coincidence that all of these shows in our toast came from 1974. To good times.
To happy days.
To Little House on the Prairie.
Woo, cheers.
Woo, 50 years.
50 years.
The information, opinions, and comments expressed on the Pop Culture Preservation Society podcast belong solely to Carolyn, the Crushologist, and Hello Newman, and are in no way representative of our employers or affiliates. And though we truly believe we are always right, there is always a first time. The PCPS is written, produced, and recorded in Minneapolis, Minnesota, home of the fictional WJM Studios and our beloved Mary Richards. Nanu Nanu, keep on truckin', and may the force be with you.